Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. New York Times columnist and Princeton University economist Paul Krugman has become one of the country's most outspoken critics of the Bush administration and the direction in which America is moving. Krugman's concerns are grave. His attacks on the handling of the U.S. economy, on alleged White House deceit, on anti-democratic government are cutting. They have drawn blood. White House supporters have savaged Krugman for his criticisms. He argues that American democracy and the American future are at risk. Last week, I interviewed Paul Krugman before a packed crowd at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston. We talked about politics, the economy, and his new book, The Great Unraveling, Losing Our Way in the New Century. Tonight on Point, Paul Krugman on America at Risk. Because the interview was recorded earlier, we won't be taking your calls this hour, but you will hear some questions from the audience. I begin by asking Paul Krugman, who has been described as America's most dangerous liberal pundit, how it felt to be himself a target.
Leave me out of the story for a moment. Just say it's an important part of what's been happening. If you're in the media, if you're a journalist, and you say anything mildly critical of the current regime, you find yourself under personal attack. Of course, your employer is always under attack for being part of the liberal media, but you yourself are under personal attack, and not simply people saying you're wrong, but little armies of helpful people go seeing that there's something they can use to discredit you personally. And that has its effect because it's very chilling. The first time it happens to you, you think that you know the world is coming to end, the sky is falling on you, and you just I believe that a lot of journalists retreat at that point. They don't say to themselves consciously, I better not offend these people, but in fact, they've been conditioned not to. And it is something to watch, and it is something to experience.
And then tell us just a little bit more on the personal front. You have put yourself into such public exposure, and I know that's not completely unfamiliar to an academic of your stature, but you've put yourself way out there. I saw you one night, late at night, on the Bill Maher show. You're sitting next to Jesse Ventura, Bill Maher, and a comic. You were absolutely on fire with the seriousness of your criticism and your points, and Jesse Ventura's, you know, saying, you know, hey, eat my boa or whatever. The contrast of your intense, almost ferocious critique and some of the forums that I see you in, I thought your head was going to explode that night. What's the motivator that puts you even out into that really kind of sometimes bawdy public arena with your message? What's the source of your ferocity, Paul Krugman?
I'm scared to death about what's happening to our country. I mean, it would be, you know, I spent, as long as we're talking about me, I wasn't actually, before getting into this, a quiet academic, I was in the policy circuit. I was going to lots of meetings around the world with bankers sitting at tables with bottles of mineral water, having learned discussions about the international monetary system, and that was very comfortable, and it was all very pleasant. And the easy route for me, with the Times column, would be to keep on doing that sort of stuff. If you aren't terrified of where this country's going and where it might be in the very near future, then you're not paying attention. And since I have been put in this position of writing for the New York Times, which is as far as dead tree media go, as good as you're going to get, I've got to use it. If we return to normal times, I think people will be quite disappointed. My columns might be a lot less fiery.
All right, but they are fiery. A couple of phrases from very recent columns: things aren't as bad as they seem; they're worse. But wait, it gets worse. The title of your new book is The Great Unraveling. We'll talk about the elements of that, but give us the picture writ large, The Great Unraveling. What is it?
Well, the title was partly to avoid having to specify, right? It is a column collection with some new material. But look, obviously there are economic problems, jobless recovery, enormous budget deficits, stuff that by itself would be extremely scary. But what really drives my concern is that it's a political crisis. The vast right-wing conspiracy is, first of all, not really hidden, and it's certainly not a myth. We are in a situation where most of the levers of power are in the hands of a coalition between a hard economic right that is really very radical, really is opposed to institutions that we've had in this country for 70 years, Social Security, Medicare, the whole social insurance state, and a cultural religious right, which I don't write about that much, but which is equally important as part of the coalition. And this is a moment in which what America is very much in the balance. It's not hard to imagine, I don't want to say this, you know, daily life for people of my class is still fine. The food is better than it used to be. The coffee is much better than it used to be. You know, ordinary stuff's fine. But if you are paying attention, you realize that we are that close to being a very different, much harsher, much less liberal country in the sense of just a place where both some economic concern for the unlucky and basic political rights that we've come to take for granted are not available anymore. And so the whole America that I grew up in is in danger of unraveling.
So it's really not just at all the economics, clearly, anymore that have you concerned. When did you wake up one morning or over some years, when did you say to yourself, I've got to bust out of economics as my meat? I've got to speak to the whole picture, because the whole picture is disturbing the politics in particular.
Yeah. I mean, I came to the Times thinking I was going to write economics. And, of course, there'd be some politics in it, but not that much. And if you actually were to go back and look at the stuff I wrote in the first year, you'd find that a lot of it was, first of all, it was economics, and to the extent it was about politics, it was political. I was trying to discuss the issues in terms of, well, there are these other people, and I disagree with them, and let me explain why it's right. And then, little by little, it became clear to me that we were not having a rational discussion. For me, actually, the issue that was candidate Bush's Social Security plan was the one where it took me actually about 12 columns on that to finally realize that they were not making sense and were not intending to make sense. It wasn't a different view, a different theory. It was just 2 - 1 = 4, and we can get away with it. So you can work your way in from environmental policy towards this grim vision of the political situation. You can work your way in from economic policy towards it. You can work it in from international affairs. And one of the things actually that's been a little bit reassuring to me is that my moderately liberal friends, who 2 years ago were telling me, you know, you're too shrill, more and more of them are sounding even shriller than I am, which I was just a little ahead of the curve.
So you began from an economics point of view, in particular with Social Security, feeling your way in, feeling something bigger. Now you've been paying a lot of attention for quite a while. What's the whole elephant look like here? What is this agenda that you feel you've discovered?
I would now say there are two main elements in it. One is the hard economic right, people who really want to unravel the whole welfare state or the social insurance state or whatever you want to call it, the whole set of the safety net. And they're quite open about it, not the people in the White House, obviously, but the people at the Heritage Foundation are quite open, saying, well, we want to get rid of all this. We want to get rid of Social Security and Medicare. We want to get rid of the Great Society and the New Deal. And they say, well, we want to cut taxes to create a lack of revenue so that these things go away, starve the beast. It's a very, very harsh vision of where they want America to go. And on the other side, there is the cultural religious right. I've been playing with words that I haven't managed to use in the column yet, but I think it's the plutocrats and the preachers. And this coalition of the plutocrats and the preachers is a very, very radical force that wants to make us into, on the economic side, something like we were in the 1920s or before.
That would mean what?
That would mean no social safety net. It would mean if you're old and you haven't saved or your savings were lost, you starve.
More power to capital, less to government.
Yes. Get away with progressive taxation. Eliminate, of course, which is actually in the law now, eliminate the estate tax. Wealth has its privileges and can be passed on to the next generation. And really no guarantees, no social responsibility for people who fall by the wayside. Well, Grover Norquist. You know, we love Grover Norquist, who's a very sinister and very powerful lobbyist. He likes to hear himself talk, so he actually says things that are more quotable than what usually comes out of these people. And one of them was, he said, I don't want to destroy the government, I just want to shrink it to the size where I can drown it in the bathtub. But the other one I liked was, somebody asked him, do you want to roll us back to the way we were before the New Deal? And he said, no, I want to roll us back to the way we were before the progressive movement. And, you know, Theodore Roosevelt, environmentalism, you know, we got to stop that. So we're going to really back to the 1890s, maybe.
And what's your reading of the why in that?
That's interesting. You know, the super rich did rather well under Bill Clinton. Why this anger? And I think part of it is that actually political movements can be driven by relatively small, highly organized, disciplined groups. So if you look at the whole network of think tanks, foundations, the media, we're not talking about all the rich people in America. We're talking about a relative handful of rich people who have financed this, who are, for whatever reason, have got a chip on their shoulders. And then you're also talking about people who become professional right-wingers. So you've created a whole class of people. And then, of course, there's all the religious right stuff, which is a whole different story.
That takes us to the cultural side of this. You see, economically, pre-New Deal, pre-progressive era even, rich and poor, or at least unprotected labor. How about on the cultural side? What's the revolution pushing for?
Well, it's
it's
a return to, or beyond a return, it's hardline, it's America's Ayatollahs, if you like. Just think about how hardline our religious right really is. Think about 9/11. The mythology is that there were liberals who were, you know, blaming America first. I never found one. But you did have some of the right-wing preachers saying this was punishment for our sins. People with that kind of mindset, there exist such people on the left. You can find them on the crazy left. But you can find them in control of political organizations with millions of members on the right.
So there's a world of robber barons and Ayatollahs. We're sort of raised to believe, though, that America has a deep base. It's kind of self-centering. You can punch it down, but it comes back to something like a median. And over time, we've seen even progressive policies emerge from that median. First of all, have you lost faith in that return to the median? And if that dynamic has been lost, how? Why?
You know, emotionally, I believe it's all going to turn out all right. I have, you know, this American-bred optimism. Intellectually, I'm not at all sure. We have some illusions about, I mean, it did turn out all right. But we tend to imagine that our history is one in which always the mass good sense of the people is always prevailed, when in fact we had several pretty near misses. PBS had a wonderful 30-year retrospect on Watergate. At the end of it, Sam Dash, one of the crucial attorneys, had this little soliloquy where he said, people think the system worked. The system didn't work. We just got lucky. If there hadn't been the tapes in the White House, if there hadn't been just a handful of people, if John Dean hadn't come forward, who knows what would have happened to our system. You know, if we get through what I perceive as this crisis now, most people will say, well, you know, it's America, the system always works. The fact is, really, I think we're going to have either a near miss or no miss at all.
If one pillar of your columns speaks to this what Henry Kissinger calls a revolutionary impulse. The other is about truth and accountability and their absence, have called an Orwellian moment that we are in. You talk and write about it all the time. Describe its dimensions.
Well, gosh. As one friend says, I'll stop calling them Orwellian when they stop using 1984 as an operations manual. But just think about how many times we're told things that are not true or even the opposite of true. On the economic front, I mean, we're told that the White House keeps on saying that. Well, you have Dick Cheney saying I'm a deficit hawk, as he presides over the biggest
$500 billion
deficit. We have George Bush saying the great bulk of my tax cuts go to people towards the bottom end of the economic spectrum. They stopped the Treasury from producing estimates anymore, but we can do what they would have, and we do know that this is rather radically not true. On foreign policy, I mean, this is the most amazing thing, the campaign to say, well, we never claimed that Iraq was an imminent threat. And this is not even, you know, hidden information. It's what we all saw watching our TVs. But they believe that they can say we've always been at war with East Asia, and the people will believe it.
We'll be back with more of my interview with New York Times columnist and Princeton University economist Paul Krugman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're back with more of my interview from the John F. Kennedy Library with Paul Krugman, New York Times columnist and Princeton economics professor. Krugman and I talked last week before a live audience. Because the interview was recorded earlier, we won't be taking your calls this hour. You talk about President Bush pursuing what you call a go-for-broke reelection strategy, a kind of, you say, a strategy to confuse the middle and energize the base. What do you mean?
I would have expected, I mean, I've been caught by surprise. I would have expected some substantive move to the center, even if they didn't intend to continue it. I would have expected, for example, they would have put enough money in for to actually fund No Child Left Behind and then strip it away after they win the election, that they would have actually extended unemployment insurance. And this is one of those little things that amazingly just passes by. Whenever there's a serious economic slump, you have federal government always puts in a temporary extension of unemployment benefits because recognizing it's a particularly hard time to find a job. And we put that in March of 2002. It was allowed to expire in December of last year. That's crazy. And the average duration of unemployment right now is more than 20 weeks. It's at a 20-year high. It's harder to find a job. People who lose a job stay unemployed for longer than at any time since the extremely severe recession of the 80s. What would it have cost them to just say, well, let's let the unemployment benefits continue until after the election? Then we can go and let workers, unemployed workers starve. But, you know, and you go down the list. We all know that they really don't want the IRS to have the resources to do its job. Mm-hmm. But they actually turned down a request for $12 million to help the IRS track down terrorist funds.
I saw that just today, to hire 50 new agents to track down terrorist
funds. It's incredible.
$12 million is about a nanosecond of a rock operation.
They won't make the smallest gesture towards the center, believing that it's just they can drown that out. And meanwhile, they're doing, of course, everything for the base. More and more tax cuts and $10.7 billion for a missile defense system that, by all accounts, is incapable of shooting down a seagull.
And at this moment, the polls, who knows what will happen? It's months to go yet. Gas prices are going up. Lots of things can happen. Unemployment's, the job creation is still not good. But President Bush, for all of the Krugman critique, is running at least neck and neck with John Kerry, if not ahead. You've begun to evolve into a kind of a political observer as well as economic. How do you interpret that?
I don't know anything about, what drives elections. I know no more than anybody who reads the papers.
But time after time, you are appealing to American citizens through your columns with a point of view. Some of it's sticking, but some of it clearly is not.
Well, the Times has a readership of a few million. That's not a lot in a country with almost 300 million people. The news people actually see is that's Fox or it's CNN, which is not Fox, but is pretty cowed. And also, look, 9/11, people reacted by wanting to believe in the goodness of, and wisdom of our leaders. And it's very hard to shake that off, to face up to the enormity of the extent to which that goodwill was abused is something that very few people want to do. And, you know, most people are getting on with their lives. So they're not paying a lot of attention. I think about the way it was 2 years ago when no one would hear any ill spoken. A large number of people have woken up. It may very well not be enough, but a large number of people have woken up.
Let's hit some of the issues point by point. I want to start in your breadbasket in the economic area, and jobs has been the number one issue so far in the campaign, jobs and national security, but jobs, their absence, their outsourcing, their frustrating non-appearance for the Republicans, for everybody, really. What do you make of what's going on with jobs and how the issue's being presented by Democrats, by the White House, to the electorate?
First, just the actual, the professional stuff. You know, politics aside, what happened?
Yeah.
And what I've been, what I tell people is that this is not your father's business cycle. It's your grandfather's business cycle. We got very accustomed to situations in which Alan Greenspan or his equivalent stopped booms before they went too far because of inflation. And for whatever reason, we had this long, long, enormous boom under Clinton without inflation, which meant that when it collapsed, it was much harder to get the economy restarted because you had all this telecommunications capacity, all of this debt that's been built up, so it's kind of hard to get it restarted. And the ordinary remedies are not enough. The Fed cuts interest rates, and it's not enough. This was a time when you really needed a lot more policy wisdom from the top than you would normally have had. And that now I can get political and say, well, look, what you needed was a program that was really designed to create jobs. And what you actually had was a White House that said, oh, goody, we can sell things we wanted to do anyway as a job creation program.
I.e. tax cuts.
Tax cuts and more tax cuts, and all tilted heavily towards people at the top end of the income distribution. You know, the big, the centerpiece of last year's tax cut was reduction in tax rates on dividends. Now, if what you're trying to do is put people to work, it's hard to think of a less effective way to increase the federal deficit than that. And not too surprisingly, when you have programs that are not designed for job creation, they do produce a little bit, but only at the edges. And now, all that said, I think we're all surprised at how little has happened. But I think that's the story, that we really needed somebody to say, okay, this is kind of a minor key version of the 30s, and what we need is a minor key version of the New Deal to respond to it. And instead, we had people who said, oh, this is a great time to do Ronald Reagan all over again, only bigger and worse.
But this wasn't ultimately a 30s-style absence of economic growth. Correct me if I'm wrong. People talk about productivity bleeding job creation away and jobs away. People talk about offshoring of jobs. It's not really a 30s redux, is it?
Well, it's, as I said, minor key. The U.S. economy was bigger in 1939 than it was in 1929. It was producing more stuff, but it was employing fewer people because productivity rose over that period. So this is all, you always, if you're talking about jobs, the economy always has to grow, not just grow, but grow faster than the increase in productivity of workers, which is not really a problem. It's just saying that what you call success is a higher number. As a matter of arithmetic, the productivity increases are why we haven't seen jobs given the economic growth, but there's nothing, no reason to say we couldn't have had bigger economic growth. Offshoring is also not really a reason why we haven't created jobs, but it's a reason why there's a little bit more to it. That is to a certain extent, bleeding purchasing power out of the economy, and it's also enormously emotional. And so if you try to do the numbers, it's 5 or 10% of the story, not the big story.
Secretary of the Treasury John Snow said, I forget the phrase, something like hunky-dory, that the offshoring of jobs was better than good. It was fine. It was what we expect from free trade.
A senior international monetary official, who also happens to be someone I know pretty well, was talking about John Snow, and he was saying that he was talking about Paul O'Neill and John Snow. Mm-hmm. He was saying that he thought that Paul O'Neill was a pretty good guy in the wrong job. That he had always thought when O'Neill was there that this was a guy who really should be running a railroad. So they got rid of Paul O'Neill, and they got somebody who'd been running a railroad. John Snow, you know, of course he says things are hunky-dory. But
of
let's
course,
let's bear in mind,
that doesn't sound too snappy.
Well, their plan seems, since they have nothing more that they're going to do, the plan is to say it's all great.
Mm-hmm. To go for broke straight.
And Bob Dole, that great economic expert, said that things are great in the Times the other day, so it must be true. I'm getting professionally snippy here, but let me say there are some terrific economists. The chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers is a very good economist. And the first thing they did on bringing somebody much better than they had a right to have on staff was to move the council out of the White House. And I don't know exactly where it is. I've been told upstairs from a Starbucks on G Street, but something like that. And everything I've heard is that when Karl Rove wants his opinion, Karl tells him what it is. So there's just no analysis going on.
Okay, so roll the tape back then. If Paul Krugman had been in charge or someone of your, you know, general inclinations in 2000 as we were heading into this recession, and it wasn't big tax cuts that caught your eye, but if you could have foreseen just how hard it would be to get job creation going again, what would that person, what would you have done?
First up, major aid to state and local governments. The big, completely unnecessary cost in all of this has been that because state and local governments are more or less required to balance their budgets year by year, when the economy has a downturn, they're obliged to start slashing spending.
But we've already got huge federal deficits, so
no, but we wouldn't have. First, we wouldn't. The tax cuts, which are very ineffectual, are responsible for more than half the federal deficit. So, you know, if you'd instead had a policy that centered on aid to state and local governments, that had supplemented that with public spending by the federal government, you know, we have large amounts of Homeland Security stuff that everybody who's looked at the subject says we should be doing, which we need to do right away, and also would actually create a fair number of jobs. So in this case, you know, you don't need
local
WPA
readiness.
Port security.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want someone to blow up a liquid natural gas tanker right off here.
No, we don't. And
we haven't done anything to stop that from happening. Mm-hmm. And the last thing is, yeah, tax cuts or rebates, but rebates, first of all, they're temporary, so they're not going to cripple the budget once the economy has recovered, but also directed towards people, like Bush said, that towards the bottom end of the economic spectrum, because those are the people most likely to spend the money. Now, how much better would it have worked? The answer is we don't know. Although it is worth pointing out that these tax cuts are, CBOS, the Congressional Budget Office estimates, are about $260 billion. They've added $260 billion to this year's deficit.
About half the deficit issue.
Yeah. $260 billion is the wages of 5.5 million average U.S. workers. I don't think even the White House is claiming that its policies have created 5.5 million more jobs than we've otherwise had. So this has been a spectacularly ineffective use of, you know, it's hard to run a deficit this big and get so little stimulus out of it.
If a Kerry administration should emerge out of the election this fall, who knows? But if it should happen, given where the country is now, with the deficits that it has now, with the tax cuts that have been made, with the Republican Congress, what's the recipe that you put in John Kerry's pocket as he walked into the White House?
It's going to be very difficult with a Republican Congress. He's going to have, I'm afraid that we're likely to have 2 years of, at least, of almost nothing being done, because it would be very difficult to pass anything. And so there is going to be a problem. It's going to be what I would and will in print advise him to do is to push a set of things that are so obviously good stuff. You know, create a package of Homeland Security spending and aid to state and local governments and rebates to lower income people, coupled with we're going to roll back tax cuts at the top end and put pressure, political pressure on Tom DeLay. To try and make him the bad guy unless he goes along with it.
And is there room, given how everything has unfolded, to actually do that? Or is Grover Norquist's fix, is it already in? Is the government, you know, ready to strangle in the bathtub?
Well, yeah.
The deficit's there. We've got very large overseas security expenditures still going on. Talk now of being in Iraq for 5 years, for 10 years. Afghanistan unresolved, you know, big security expenditures in any case, whoever's in the White House.
Well, this is where you need the numbers. And actually, the numbers are pretty depressing. But let me say, it doesn't matter what you do for 1 or 2 years. The U.S., you know, if you told me we have a $500 billion deficit this year, but I saw some credible path back towards balance, no problem.
You're calm.
We can handle that.
You're down with that.
Yeah, we're perfectly okay. You know, you can do that for a bit. You know, during the in fiscal 1942, we ran a budget deficit of 28% of GDP, which I guess would be basically $3 trillion now. You can do that for a little while, as long as there's a reason to think that you will be fiscally responsible later on.
Yep.
The trouble is that given the tax cuts, given the spending, it doesn't go down. But realistic estimates say that we run $400 to $500 billion deficits for the next 10 years, and then it gets worse because the baby boomers start retiring. And what they've done, we would have trouble even without the Bush tax cuts. But what they've done is to create facts. They've ratcheted the whole system down. So yeah, Grover Norquist has gotten a substantial distance towards what he wants, except that at some point. In the not-too-distant future, some politician has to be able to say to the American people, look, we have a choice. We have to roll back a lot of these tax cuts, most of which don't affect most people, but still, it's not just the wealthy, or Social Security and Medicare are going to be gutted. And that's the truth, and it's going to have to it's going to have to be explained at some point. But
you're saying that's the path we're on now.
Yeah, we have a.
But I've read you saying there's a doomsday scenario being spread about Social Security. That's not necessarily so.
No, what people say about Social Security is it's a huge problem, so huge that these tax cuts are trivial in comparison. It's not true. Actually, the tax cuts are about three times as big as the amount that they need to secure Social Security indefinitely. The tax cuts are a bigger part of our fiscal problem, much bigger than Social Security. Social Security is a minor issue. Medicare is a bigger issue. But even so, it's just a sense of magnitudes. There's this funny kind of thing that you get from the White House and its defenders, which is to say, "Ooh, you know, yes, we have huge budget deficit problems, but that's all because of the social insurance programs, and therefore, we did no harm." Things were so bad already that by reducing federal revenue by 15% through our tax cuts, it really didn't make a difference. And the truth is actually it made the difference between manageable problems and completely unmanageable ones.
Are you suggesting then that when John Kerry says, "I want to take back the tax cuts for the wealthy," he's not being fully straightforward, that a Democrat or unlike-minded Republican in the White House would actually have to take back all the tax cuts?
Some way we need, doesn't have to be necessarily those tax cuts. Let's say this carefully. We need some combination of spending cuts and tax increases that amount to something like, in the end, 4% of GDP, which the Bush tax cuts are about 2.5% of GDP. Mm-hmm. So even rolling them all back is not enough to actually close the gap.
Where's it come from?
That's something we're going to have to. I mean, it's not even really politically discussable now. I mean,
we're just friends here.
Well, no, but I think the point is that a lot of it. I think actually can come from. There's a large enforcement gap. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of things that we used to think of as trivial issues. It used to be that we'd say, well, you know, higher taxes on the rich, you know, that may satisfy your sense of social justice, but there really isn't that much money there. Mm-hmm. In 1970, there wasn't. Now the rich are so rich that there is. Mm-hmm. We used to say enforcement issues were not a big issue. You know, yes, of course, there's cheating. We should make people pay. It was not a big issue. Now there's so much cheating going on by really wealthy people and corporations that enforcement issues could get it back. But then, and corporate profits tax, one of the great stories, untold stories of America is the withering away of the corporate profits tax. So you probably can get a fair bit out of that if we find a way back. But yeah, I think a reasonable first step is to, I think put it this way, I think that sooner or later if we have a halfway responsible government, it's going to roll back all of the Bush tax cuts except the 10% bracket, the marriage exemption, and the child tax credits, which means that you'd be rolling back 80% of the total value, but 80% of the population will not be affected.
We'll be back with more of my interview with New York Times columnist Paul Krugman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're back with more of my interview at the John F. Kennedy Library with economist and New York Times columnist Paul Krugman. Krugman and I talked last week before a live audience. Because the interview was recorded earlier, we won't be taking your calls this hour. Let me just ask you about Alan Greenspan. You wrote recently, you said Alan Greenspan has chutzpah. You said he has betrayed his institution, the Federal Reserve, and he has betrayed his nation. How?
Okay, let me start with the institution. We have built up over these last couple of decades a system where we put this. The idea is monetary policy, this ability to set interest rates, is so powerful and at the same time technical and quick in its effects that we wanted to depoliticize it. So we put monetary policy in the hands of these central bankers who are appointed for long terms, not really subject to ordinary political accountability, and there's a kind of a deal They're going to manage the economy in a non-political way, and they themselves, of course, have to stand above politics. So that's the deal as we always understood it. And I actually used to tell my students that the Supreme Court is for monetary. The Federal Reserve is for monetary policy. What the Supreme Court is for the legal and political system, and it must be beyond reproach, above politics.
You used to tell your
students. Of course, yes. We're now 0-2, and so Greenspan betrayed his institution by injecting himself crucially in support of the administration's economic agenda, and generally by pushing for a downsized government, lower tax, lower social benefits, using his position as head of the Federal Reserve, which it's perfectly all right for someone to have those views, but in that position, he's supposed to who elected him? He's supposed to. He's been given enormous power on condition that he stay out of the political sphere.
Are you suggesting it's the first time Alan Greenspan has done that? There were times during the Clinton years where he appeared to be helpful.
During the Clinton years, no. Actually, during the Clinton years, he talked a lot about deficits are bad.
So did the Clintons.
But that's a different thing from saying, right now he's saying deficit is bad and I want it to be closed by cutting spending, not by raising taxes. That's saying deficits are bad. That can be a technical judgment. Mm-hmm. They hurt the economy. Saying and the way to resolve it is by moving to the right. That's beyond the bounds. And the other thing to say is that Greenspan has in fact the things he wants to do about the deficit are kind of let water trickling through the fingers. He was all very harsh on deficits when Democrats controlled Congress and the White House and might have increased spending. He's very weak on them now when Republicans keep on cutting taxes. And as a result, he has actually, if you ask what single individual outside the administration itself did the most to get us into this deficit hole we're in, it would be Alan Greenspan.
And when Paul Krugman thinks something, we read about it soon enough. Something I saw on the web this afternoon, guerrilla-style posters in Times Square that read, Paul Krugman's Army. Let the truth be told, and there's a kind of black and white silhouette of an impish Che Guevara mode Paul Krugman.
It's actually just the Times photo, badly printed.
Yeah.
And it's available in T-shirts. And I am not involved with the marketing. In fact, I bought a dozen for friends.
I welcome your questions, and let's start right here, sir.
Yes, by cutting long-term unemployment insurance, vetoing funding for communications equipment for first responders, maintaining that the tax cuts should be permanent. Many elements of this administration are looked upon as the affability of evil. And many Americans are just dumbfounded that the administration is continuing on the path that they're on. So my question is, do you think it's time that the mainstream broadcast journalists take the helm that Walter Cronkite did 40 years ago during Vietnam, where he went to Vietnam and said it's a quagmire, and we have to address it? Because it seems that Peter Jennings and Dan Rather and Tom Brokaw fear doing that.
Actually, at this point, I just settle for them not being so much enablers of the administration, let alone taking a stand against it. Look, after we went to war and didn't find any of those WMD, Christiane Amanpour of CNN gave an interview a little bit too frank. She said that perhaps to some extent I and even my station were intimidated by the administration and its foot soldiers at Fox News. And Fox News immediately issued a statement saying, better to be viewed as a foot soldier for Bush than as a spokeswoman for al-Qaeda. And that's the kind of environment that we've been operating in. There are many, many stories about journalists passing along administration stories that they know to be false or helping along. Right now, the smearing of Richard Clark, amazing stuff is happening, and people are a fair number of people in the media are actively culpable.
Active allies, conscious,
yes.
Deliberate allies.
Yes. Yeah.
Partisans, then.
What, sorry?
Partisans, then.
Well, partisans are just going where the power is, which is not quite the same thing. Mm-hmm. Fox is partisan. Some of the other people are just, they're just too happy to go along. Very difficult to make a stand against it, and you would be fired, I believe, very quickly if mainstream broadcaster, if Peter Jennings or somebody tried to do that. I think it's a very difficult environment. There is no Walter Cronkite now. And there's not an environment. Walter Cronkite would be fired if he tried it right now.
But even Walter Cronkite took some time to go public with his criticism of Vietnam. I guess the question arises again off this. Are we in a new age, a different age? Is the media so very different now, or has the party in power figured out more effectively how to position itself vis-a-vis the media?
America in the 60s. Now I'm playing amateur historian. I play amateur a lot of things these days. But America in the 60s, despite all of the abuses we know about, and despite J. Edgar Hoover and COINTELPRO and all of that stuff, there were multiple power centers. The unions were still very powerful. The media were quite separate. They weren't just part of larger corporate empires. There was a lot more room to maneuver. Right now, there's a very strong sense that there's no... You take these people on, and you are fair game, and it's not clear anyone will stand up for you. Anyone powerful will. So I think things have changed. I think that although the Nixon administration went a pretty long way on abuse of power, and we got lucky. But I think actually the natural defenses of the country were stronger than they are now.
Do you feel the yo-yo reaching the end of the string here? That this may reverse, that the media may become more critical, or you're not confident of that?
I have seen it's a little bit better, but not much. I think public opinion has moved more than the media have.
Question.
Yes, I'd like to draw you out a little more on the solution of the unemployment problem, aside from retraining, whatever that might be, and the outsourcing. How might outsourcing end, if it ever does, and who has the answers? Who has put together a program? You've made some suggestions today. Has anyone put together a program, Kerry or some economists or others, so that a layman can understand this? And finally, what does your colleague Milton Friedman have to say about all this?
Well, I haven't talked to Friedman. I haven't talked to him more than four or five times in my life altogether anyway, but certainly not talking to him now. He's in semi-retirement in California, and we're not.
Pick up the unemployment question.
The unemployment question.
More depth. You know, people are afraid that even if the country did everything right, that we sort of lost our headroom. What rung of the ladder do you go to when R&D can be done in Bangalore or Shanghai?
All right. Now, here's the textbook answer is that if they really could do everything as well as we could, then their wages would be soaring. That you'd have why is labor so cheap in India and China? And the answer is really because overall they're still very low productivity countries, and there's a few places where they've made major gains, and so in those few places they become unstoppable exporters. And so the theory says, well, you know, this is really an adjustment issue. It's localized, which is, you know, not much compensation for people who are in the way of it, and easy for me to say, but this ought to be a manageable size issue with adjustment assistance and a vigorous domestic economy. And you'll go back and say, look, there was a time not that long ago when people said, you know, South Korea, low wages, they're getting technologically sophisticated, how can we ever compete, and what happened to South Korean wages? Increased by a factor of five.
But they didn't have a billion more people just over
well,
the horizon.
Well, then you try to say, oh, you know, it sounds like there's just so many of them. But it comes back to these. If you run it through the textbook stuff, it says that this ought not to be a fundamental problem. That's not much of an answer. And then the question is, what do you say now? What does a generally free market-oriented, free trade-oriented liberal say now? And the answer, I think, is you say, okay, we're going to provide at least a few speed bumps. We're going to try and slow it up, require notification. We're going to promise more assistance. We're going to do something about health care, and we're going to stimulate the domestic economy, and we're going to hope that it will kind of fade out as a central concern with a successful economy. The model for that is what happened with the Japanese menace in the early 90s. We were all terrified of Japan stealing all our jobs, and then kind of strong domestic economy, and it sort of became manageable, not because we stopped buying lots of Japanese cars, but because we got it in better perspective once the domestic economy is doing well. If that doesn't happen, then we're going to have a huge rethink.
What are Americans going to be doing then? If everything went swimmingly, 15 years from now, What kind of jobs? People are having trouble simply imagining what it is they'll do that couldn't be done more cheaply somewhere else where technology can be shipped over the web.
And then the answer is it's always hard to envisage that. But what the story, if you go through this, is every time that something that we thought was cutting edge moves overseas, you say, well, there'll be nothing more. And then it turns out there is something. You know, they were in the early 80s, there was a group of Democrats who were thought they were on the cutting edge. They were known as the Atari Democrats. That was their big thing. And then Atari moved overseas, and the whole video game thing moved overseas. Everybody said, oh, you see, hopeless, and America is never going to make a comeback. We're lost to the Japanese. So the story goes in various ways, and turns out there is stuff. Now, you know, it's all really easy to say. But I think if you ask, what do you propose now? What you propose is modest measures that don't stray over the line into outright protectionism and domestic economic stimulus, and hope that that the textbook is right. But it 2 or 3 years, if it isn't, then you say, well, okay, maybe we really need to think more about this whole free trade thing. I don't think it'll get there. But
you would be willing to reconsider free trade?
You know, everything I think I know, everything that's in the leading undergraduate international trade textbook, which I happen to have written, it says that it should work out, that this is really transitional, and it's mostly a function of a weak domestic economy. But of course, if you know, as John Maynard Keynes said, when I receive new facts, I change my opinion. What do you do, sir? So I'm prepared to reconsider, but I don't think I've seen that evidence now.
I'm going to steal the one last question. We've scarcely touched it, but we are practically out of time. The war on terror and Iraq, your basic view on where we're headed.
I don't know anything more than any, you know, fairly well-read person about national security. And I mean, I came out anti-Iraq war fairly early because I could just see that the selling of the policy was just like the selling of the economic policies. I said, there they go again. It just feels the same. And even though I don't know anything myself about weapons of mass destruction, this doesn't sound like people who have a good case, and it sounds like there's another pet peeve. I also understood, just in a vague sense, that there are limited resources. Economists are supposed to understand that. Satirical magazines and websites have been much more accurate than allegedly serious news all these days. You know, and there's something called Ironic Times that I occasionally read, and they had their description of U.S. foreign policy is, we're sending a message to the world: if you attack us, we will strike back at someone else with overwhelming force. And that doesn't seem like a sensible policy. And of course, now more is coming out, and it's much worse than I imagined. And this is scary. I mean, you know, realistically, Islamic terrorists are not going to bring down the West. They're not going to bring down the United States. There's a fundamental huge imbalance of power, but they can kill a lot of innocent people. Well, Richard Clark's book, he says that we could not have, I'm paraphrasing here, but if Osama bin Laden had scripted our response to 9/11, he couldn't have done better than what we've actually done in terms of providing exactly the diversion of resources that allowed al-Qaeda to probably become much, much harder to wipe out now, and giving the perfect cause, the perfect motivator for more of these guys. So it's a real disaster.
Paul Krugman, we are awed at your prodigious feistiness and your prodigious even ferocity, and we thank you for spending this time with us tonight. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
New York Times columnist Paul Krugman, last Wednesday at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Amata, Julie Jupp, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Shipman, and Tim Skog, with help from Jane Manners, Michael Garth, and Darren Manoogian. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.